tonight on Arena. In TV reviews, Dying for Sex and Pulse, and in albums, Brandy Carlile and Elton John and The Waterboys. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. So it's Friday night, so it's obviously TV review time. First up, Disney brings us the comedy drama Dying for Sex, which was inspired by the podcast of the same name. The plot centres on Molly, played by Michelle Williams, a woman recently diagnosed with incurable cancer, who feels suffocated by her husband Steve, who no longer sees her as a sexual being. Facing mortality, she abruptly leaves him to explore her sexuality for the first time with the support of her best friend Nick. Next, The Bondsman is an action horror series on Prime Video. It follows rugged bounty hunter Hub Halloran, played by Kevin Bacon, who is brutally murdered in the opening scene, but miraculously comes back to life. Unfortunately, he later discovers that Satan resurrected him so that he can hunt down murderous demons that have escaped from hell. More of that in a while. And finally, we have Pulse, Netflix's first foray into the world of the medical procedural drama. Set in Miami's McGuire Medical Center, the series follows the personal and professional lives of its staff during a hurricane. There are lots of high-stakes medical emergencies with sharp focus on Doctors Denny Sims, played by Willa Fitzgerald, and her ex, Dr. Alexander Phillips, played by Colin Woodell, who were an item, but now they seem to be at war. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser have been watching all three and join me now in studio. Let's begin with Dying for Sex, and we have a clip here that might set it up. Molly tells her friend Nikki that her cancer has returned and it's incurable. Michelle Williams is Molly and Ginny Slate is Nikki.
I'm sorry, were you busy?
I'm on my way to rehearsal. Are you smoking cigarettes? What is that, menthols? Oh my God, who are you? Are you my camp boyfriend? What is this?
You know how I had that pain in my hip that wouldn't go away? It's cancer. It's back.
But you... It's been 2 years.
I know.
You did everything that the doctor said and you took all of the drugs and...
It's not fair.
Still...
I don't want to die just when I'm getting used to my new boobs.
Nah, you're not gonna die.
I am, actually. It, metastasized to my bones. It's incurable.
One second, I'm so sorry.
Hey.
I'm sorry.
Babe, it's okay. It's okay.
No, I feel like it's just gonna get a little bit bigger. Just let me. What?
Just kidding, I'm fine.
You are?
No.
Oh my God, what the fuck?
Sorry, I don't know why I said that.
What the fuck? What the fuck?
Right, I'm not doing
what
a very good
doing?
Job with this. I don't know. I don't
what
know. I don't
it?
Know how to do this. I don't know how to tell you that I'm gonna die.
Yeah, you're bad at this. This is a bad way to tell me. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Oh God.
Michelle Williams there as Molly and Ginny State as Nikki, her friend, who is taking the news very badly about her friend. So, Jen, this started as a podcast.
Yes. So it is based on a true story from 2020 was when the podcast came out. And it centres around the life of the real life Molly Koshan. And she hosted this podcast, Dying for Sex, with her best friend, Nikki. And basically, it was due to the fact that, as she said, you know, she had limited time and she didn't want to spend that time in a marriage with her, you know, then now ex-husband, where she felt like she was being treated as a patient, as seen as, you know, someone too fragile to engage in real life in full-blooded sexuality. And also she wanted the drugs that she was on, which usually would quash somebody's libido, they had the reverse effect on her. So her libido was heightened, like she was saying, she was going around like a teenage boy. And she wanted to, you know, relish that opportunity. And if it wasn't going to be with her husband, she was going to try and get out there into the digital world and go on dating apps and meet up for hookups and really discover herself, like really discover what it is about her body. Because in one way, her body was failing her obviously, at that time. But at the same time, she had to relish what she had left and what, you know, beauty that there was and what she could, the joy that she could find within the physical. So that's really what the podcast was about and became this sensation. And then ended up, you know, at the doorstep of like a screenwriter. One of the screenwriters is Liz Merriweather, who was one of the showrunners for New Girl, which was a straightforward sitcom, straightforward enough. And then you had the Only Murders in the Building producer and playwright Kim Rosenstock. They got together and said this could be a great TV show, and they were helped by Leslie Headland, who's also an amazing writer, and she was one of the showrunners for Russian Doll, the Netflix show.
And Chris, it's a big coup getting Michelle Phillips to play.
Yeah, with Michelle Williams, I mean,
I was thinking of the Waterboy, sorry, yeah. Michelle Williams.
No, but Michelle Williams, you start at 5 stars and then you come down if you have to. I mean, she's a terrific talent, and it's been a while. I mean, she obviously would have started her career on television
on Dawson's Creek.
But it's gone on to be quite a successful actress on the big screen. But she is very good here. Not only does she fully inhabit Molly, she kind of actually looks like the real Molly Cochran. This is quite an interesting setup because we know how this story ends from the, you know, there is no happy ending here. So it's all about telling this story as respectfully and as authentically as possible. So Nikki Boyer, I think, was actually involved, and you know, they've got an awful lot of material to work with because they had the podcast, but they also had, I think Molly was actually writing a memoir at one stage when she was in hospital. So that gives the series sometimes, I mean, it does have that kind of breezy sitcom effect where every episode is only about 30 or 35 minutes long, but it's also quite novelistic in tone. Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. And what I mean by that is, you know, Molly might be, you know, taking a car ride with Nikki, or she might be at home, or she might be in a conversation with her husband, and we hear her thoughts. And so that gets a little bit heavy-handed at times, but her performance, though, is fantastic. Saying that, I came away from this series thinking I was going to be raving about Michelle Williams. It's Jenny Slate, for me, is the star of the show. I mean, it's not
this
supposed to.
This is the hysterical woman we heard there.
With Nikki, yeah, yes. Yeah, yeah. She is the best friend that we've either been or we've either known at some point in her life. She's all over the place. She's so uncoordinated. She has a bag that you could fall into and never be found again. And that just completely stresses Molly out whenever, you know, they go for the hospital appointments and they're trying to find something in it. She's just so all over the place, but she is also her friend's carer. The scariest thing for her is not that, you know, she's going to lose a friend. She will at some point. Is how do I accept this responsibility for the first time? And I found her fascinating to watch.
And Jenna, how does this opening up of her sexuality and this experimentation then marry with this whole, facing her own mortality?
I feel like we have been treated to, when I say treated, like ironically, to this a lot of nihilistic blankness about women enduring sex without pleasure. And, you know, a lot of torture porn, like everything from like The Handmaid's Tale to any detective show you want to watch these days would have a graphic rape scene or whatever. Whereas this, you don't see a show that is grounded in displaying sex as something to be enjoyed by women on their terms. I mean, Sex and the City ended in 2004. And just like that, there's not that much sex in that anyway. And I feel like something like Dying for Sex is part of a much bigger conversation. Like, we're looking at things like the Miranda July, you know, book All Fours, or Nicole Kidman and Baby Girl, and it's about this willingness to explore female sexuality over the age of 35, which is such a relief. And the relief about this as well is it's not hot and heavy at the beginning. Like, you see, it's hilarious because you see her kind of fumbling, Molly kind of fumbling at the sense of who she is in relation to sex, and you see her, you know, watching, like getting titillated by watching the scene in Speed where Keanu Reeves lets Sandra Bullock drive the bus for the, you know, at the first time, to gets her to do the bus driving. And it's about the range of sexuality and arousal that women have and how different it is for men. And I thought it was really interesting that, like the real Molly, Michelle Williams in it is never topless, and you never see, like, not full frontal at all. Whereas, and you're used to that on TV. You're used to casually seeing women naked. Whereas this is men that do all the work. So there's a lot of graphic scenes, full frontal nudity with a lot of men in this. So be warned. But I did think that About Turn was something that all the female showrunners of this show were trying to put out there. It's very much grounded in what is it that women want and what is it that Molly wants, and that discovery. But also, it's kind of dealing with the fact that Molly has a very traumatic event that happened in her childhood that made sex something else. It made her not want to let go. And dying for sex is about letting go. It's about Molly letting go of her physical body, of not, you know, being around anymore and having to deal with that mortality, but also about letting go sexually and becoming alive through sex.
And Chris, what kind of men does she encounter and how are the men portrayed in it?
Awful men. Her husband, Steve, he is just, I mean, we meet them. The first scene is at a couple's therapy session where Steve is talking about, they're talking about the fact that they haven't had sex in 3 years. And, you know, Molly's libido is sky high, but Steve just doesn't want to touch her. And as Jen was saying, he kind of treats her as a patient and nothing more.
This is because of her illness.
This is because of her illness. But, you know, she's been well for the last 2 years and yet still there's no, you know, there's no physical connection between the two of them and it's all down to him. But there's more than that. He's gotten used to telling her and she's gotten used to almost letting him tell her what she wants. Every time she says she wants something, he's like, no, that's not what you want. And he kind of organizes, he controls what she puts into her body, what she has for her dinner. He is a total head of ball. Like, she does need to leave this person. So he's quite awful. She does, Molly later on then encounters some guys who are better, but who are also a little bit clueless. For me, probably the star male, despite the fact that he does engage in some very unusual behavior, is Rob Delaney.
Yeah, is he a next door neighbor?
He's a next door neighbor who is
which she can hear through the the wall. Yeah,
they can hear one another through the wall, and that gets a little bit strange. But he is a complete mess. Molly encounters him in the elevator whenever she's coming home, and he's eating tacos in the elevator and has food all over his face. He's got, you know, rubbish piling up outside the house. They're warring neighbors, but then they have this very awkward encounter, which should make you kind of maybe think that he's very, very strange. But Rob Delaney has this kind of weird knack about him where even when he's doing something that, you know, other characters that you would hate them for, you kind of end up finding him more endearing.
Oh, he's warm. He's endearing. Yeah. And also, I think there's a great notion about this show where Sonia, who is kind of Molly's death doula almost, she's in palliative care and she is trying to say to her, look, Molly is like, am I weird for wanting to do all this stuff and not maybe want to have full-blown sex with these strangers, but maybe like experience like the variety of whatever sexuality is on the spectrum. And Sonia says, do not feel any guilt, basically, and that you're not weird and you want to just experience happiness. And I think there's something, that message is so strong for a lot of women out there, I think, that feel maybe shame around sexuality.
Jen referenced Sex and the City there. Is this a series that's more for women than for men?
No, I don't believe so. No, I didn't watch it thinking, oh, women are going to enjoy this an awful lot more than men because the men are portrayed as pretty awful. I mean, that usually is the case in real life, and it certainly was the case in Molly's life. She was in a joyless, sexless marriage and she needed to get out. So I'm happy that they're actually doing it, you know, in an authentic fashion. I might have liked it a little less than Jen, but I don't think it was down to the fact that this is not a series for men. I found maybe sometimes the characters were a little bit unlikable. There are scenes here where there's a scene where Molly is having sex in the back of a taxi and the taxi driver is just horrified, and I felt very sorry for the taxi driver.
But I also like that, because I also like that you see how selfish Molly is in this journey that she's on, whereas the Nikki character gets the fuzzy end of the lollipop, and you see the complexity of, everybody talks about, you know, the strength of female friendships, but there's also like parts of female friendships that need to be examined about how extreme they are, how intense they are. And that's the way it is with Nikki and Molly, because Nikki wants to be there for her best friend. It is a heartbreaking scene where Molly is, you know, the Rob Delaney character is coming into Molly's apartment. Nikki goes outside, and what is she doing? She's sitting on the floor outside the apartment sorting through Molly's medical bills and arranging her next appointments. And that's pushing that friendship so far. And I like the way you get to see that complexity. And I think Jenny Slate is fantastic in this role. We know those awards are going to go to Michelle Williams because she has to do so much work here, and she does it just with her eyes. Sometimes you can tell so much, but Jenny Slate is, it's a towering performance from her, and also Sissy Spacek as Molly's mother, a brilliant role.
We've a demon killer who's waiting for us to review him. How many stars for you for Dying for Sex, Jen?
I'm going to say it's so full of life for something that's so heavy, and you nearly forget how much what will happen in the end in that way, because you're so it's so enjoyable. And I think it's striking, like an unvarnished lust for life that is really bewitching. I thought 5 out of five.
Five out of five from you and from you, Chris.
I do think it is quite messy, but the performances are great. And despite the fact that we know where it's going and it is going to end somewhere tragic, I am keen to see how it gets there. So I'm going to go with a solid three.
Okay. So that's Dying for Sex. Now we're on to The Bondsman. Chris, tell us about this tug between heaven and hell, or maybe just the world and hell.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of hell in here. It's Kevin Bacon dead in the first scene, but then alive for the rest of the series, thankfully. So he plays a guy named Hope
Halloran. And so gorily dead.
The sound team on this are really working overtime. But Hope Halloran is his name. He is a bounty hunter. He's working for his mother, played by Beth Grant. Her name is Kitty. She runs a bail bondsman business. And we know the score. Hope shows up at a motel. He's here to, you know, take in the bad guys that haven't paid their debts. He does so. His methods are great. I mean, he's throwing a hornet's nest into a room in order to get the bad guys to come out. They do come out, and unfortunately, it doesn't end well for Hub. But the next day, he wakes up, his throat having been cut, between the walls of two motel rooms, and realizes, and he has no memory of, like, he's thinking to himself, how did I get here? But I need to get out. He gets out. The wound heals miraculously. He shows up at the gangsters who were trying to, you know, one of the gangsters who basically tried to have him killed, played by Damon Herriman. He's actually in a relationship with Hub's ex-wife. The gangsters, we don't know why they were trying to kill him. We'll find that out later. But they're horrified because they're like, you were dead. As it turns out, Hub died, went to hell, but hell spat him back out because they need him. It turns out other demons have escaped from hell. They need him to keep doing what he was doing before he died. But instead of, you know, chasing down gangsters, he's going to be chasing down demons.
Yes, as strangely, he wanted to fix his neck, not because he was dead, but because he wanted to smoke a cigarette.
Yeah.
So let's hear a clip from this. This is Hub returns home after his death and tries to avoid his mother's questions. Kevin Bacon as Hub and Beth Grant as Kitty.
Mama? I need your help. I need to find the Earl brothers right away. What's he doing here?
Hub, manners.
You kicked my mama out of your church. What do you want?
Ron and I were just discussing that...
Your mother and I have been making amends and discussing her returning to the congregation. If
my son would just stop detaining skips during Sunday services.
I'll think about it.
Hub, that is rude. I am so sorry, Ron.
I'll let myself out. Kitty, come see me anytime you like, and I'll be praying for both of you.
Thank you.
Bye now.
What has got into you?
Mama, I need to find the Earl brothers tonight. They stole your truck.
Why on earth?
I thought Billy Earl was still in jail.
Mm-mm. Posted last Monday.
Yeah, but his brothers don't have that kind of money. Who bailed them out?
Lucky Callahan.
Lucky Callahan?
Now, don't get all bent out of shape about some asshole who don't know dipshit from apple butter. Lucky will just go away as soon as you and Marianne work things out like you always do. She just wants you to show up for yourself.
So the Earls are just hired hands. He was Lucky.
Well, what in the world would Lucky want with my old truck? Well, where are you off to now?
Well, go see that piece of shit. Show up for myself.
Well, good. It's about time. Because I will not have my grandson becoming a Red Sox fan under the tutelage of some carpetbagger. You hear me?
There's a lot to unpick there. Mm. So Lucky is the man, a bad man,
yes,
who is now with his ex-wife.
Exactly.
Yeah, and his mother then is so sedate, talks about the preacher. The preacher is not a good man.
No.
Yeah, so it all get, you know, it's I think it's very funny, but you don't
like it. I mean, like, Lucky, first of all, we're 2019's favourite Charles Manson, Damon Merriman, who played Charles Manson in Mindhunter and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood in the same year. He's wasted in this, and I feel like a lot of people are wasted in this because Kevin Bacon, it's so good to see him on screen where he's not in an ad. Like, when was the last time you saw that? And like, he's perfect for this role because he's so grizzled. That's his whole deal. That's his whole shtick, and he's really...
Yes, and he's so knowing. He almost nods to us
through
the screen.
And you know, he has that very much sarcastic edge, and this sounds like it should be like this rip-roaring adventure because it's set in the States. It could be like Justified meets The X-Files meets Buffy, but it just, as you can hear there, like, they're bumping up that dialogue, I think, because I think Beth Grant, you know, is great. She's never not good.
Mother, yeah.
And It sounds stuck. That dialogue is not as funny as it should be. If you want to make this show that's kind of a bit surreal, obviously, like that has that Buffy edge to it, but it's not that clever.
But Chris, what about the gore? I mean, they're fight scenes. He's taken on the demons.
Oh, it is gory, yeah. People are losing their limbs. They're being twisted in ways they shouldn't by demons. I mean, like Kevin Bacon, he dies within the first 5 minutes and it's in quite a vicious, violent manner. It is quite gory, a little bit cartoonish. I was wondering how the Prime Video budget didn't extend to the visual effects departments. I mean, there are special effects in here that wouldn't look out of place mm-hmm. in Buffy or The X-Files, as Jen mentioned. But I liked that. I had to check at the beginning to make sure that Stephen King wasn't involved in some sort of way, because it sometimes, you know, walks, talks and swears like a really old school King joint, and maybe that's why I liked it, and also I liked it because Kevin Bacon, I mean, again, like I do wonder if the role of Hub, I should say, wasn't supposed to be, if he's not supposed to be a younger man, because there's only 9 years between Beth Grant and Kevin Bacon. So it is a little strange
yes.
to have them playing a mother and son character. And the way she kind of talks about him, and then especially when we get to know Marianne, played by Jennifer Nettles, that's Hub's ex-wife, you get the feeling that they're only supposed to be maybe their late 40s or 50s, but we'll leave the age complications aside. I really liked Kevin Bacon in this, and I thought he's very well suited to that sort of gory but sort of goofy action horror. And you know, there's a good supporting cast there too. I thought Beth Grant was great. We actually get to see an awful lot more of Beth Grant in this thing than we usually do.
It's like a buddy son and mother.
Yeah, she's the God fearing mother, and he's the hellhound in that way. And like there is, but I don't think that dynamic goes far enough or is clever enough. And I think he has a minor chemistry with his ex-wife, like Jennifer Nettles. Like there's just nothing between the two of them, I think. And also, he sings a lot in this. Can we just talk about, like,
he does
the singing of it all? Like, I was not expecting that.
And no, it's a bit
strange. His ex-wife is
kind of a country singer,
so yes. he goes and joins her.
Yes, yeah. Why? I mean, that's part of my own personal hell. Like, for me, I was like, this needs to stop now. And I did think, like, for something that is a Monster of the Week show, mm-hmm. all the monsters kind of melded into one for me. They weren't differentiated enough.
But is it supposed to be funny? So is that why it's a bit low tech and everything?
And maybe, yeah. There is something very old school about it. It does feel like a show that, you know, maybe even Kevin Bacon would have made in the 90s.
Or the 80s.
Yeah, yeah. But I quite liked it. Maybe because we don't get enough of those shows anymore. I like the whole Demon of the Week aspect. There is a wider mystery in the background. Something involving, you know, maybe hell spilling over into Earth. There's a reason why Hope's back. There's also a missing person in the town that keeps being brought up all the time. And there's the fact that, you know, why did the Damon Harriman gangster want to off Hub in the first place? So there is a wider story in there. There's also a great character in Jolene Purdy's Midge, who's this low-level representative for Satan on Earth.
Oh, I love her.
Yeah, she gets the terrible job of having to sit down, almost like she's from an employment agency, and saying, listen, this is your job, and Bacon's not too happy about it. Well, if he's not too happy about it, well, then straight back to hell with you. I liked that little dynamic. So it is totally flawed. It should be maybe better than it is, but it's a dead Kevin Bacon hunting demons. I like that.
Stars out of 5 from you, Chris.
I'll go for another 3.
Another 3. And from you, Jen.
I just think it was a hodgepodge too much. I think if they had streamlined it, like, I think the family complications, the singing of it all, that's a whole other show. Just give me Kevin Bacon fighting monsters and that would have been fine. So it's 2.5.
Yeah, I'm ignoring the singing. Yeah. I'm just pretending that doesn't exist. Yeah.
We have to deal with it.
I must say I liked it. But anyway, Pulse. So this is where Kevin Bacon will end up if he keeps getting injured like he's been getting. It's a new procedural drama.
Yes.
Jen, I mean, on Netflix.
TV is falling back in love with the medical procedural. Now, any Grey's Anatomy fans out there will tell you that they never fell out of love with it in the first place. But there has been this real nostalgia about Eeyore. I mean, right now, The Pitt, starring Noah Wiley, who was Dr. Carter in Eeyore, as this other harried doctor, is ruling American primetime TV. So, of course, Netflix wanted to jump aboard. Now, this is very different. And it begins with this oncoming hurricane that causes a bus of student athletes to careen off a bridge into the ocean. And I know that sounds like a thrilling opening gambit for something like Eeyore. And we learn about the doctors through, like, you know, the strengths, their strengths and weaknesses and their relationships through how they care for the patients. But Pulse doesn't really care about that kind of thing. Like, Pulse doesn't bother with subtleties or intricate storyline. And I have to say, the CGI for the bus crash, it looks like it was created on, I don't know, Microsoft 95. It's terrible, and it's a terrible rendering, and they don't care about the kids that are in the crash. And that is the thing that good medical dramas do. They kind of knit those two together. So what the show really cares about is the story of this third year resident, Danny Sims, played by Willa Fitzgerald. She's accused her supervisor, the chief resident, Xander Phillips, of sexual harassment. Xander's put on administrative leave, and in his absence, Danny gets the job. And this is immediately suspect, of course, and she accuses him of harassment and then directly, you know, benefits from the harassment. What's going on here? So isn't that always the way things work with women? So, you know, it kind of skips then from the day-to-day timeline into these flashbacks.
Okay, well, let's go into that relationship. There are flashback scenes, so we get to know what happens that now has Xander Phillips in trouble and out of work with the hospital, but they bring him back because there's a hurricane. In this flashback scene, resident Denny says, it treats a patient, but chief resident Xander Phillips rebukes her.
Dr. Sims, right? You know this guy?
Santino Cuesta. He was my patient. Came in with a dog bite yesterday. He was fine.
He's not anymore. His family found him unconscious. His pressure's tanking. Give me an 80ET2, please.
Yes, doctor. The bite was superficial. We cleaned it, updated his tetanus, gave him antibiotics.
All right, section, please. I can see the cords.
He's still tacky on discharge. Not the bite, it's the dog. He needs a fast exam. I bet he's got a ruptured spleen.
Right, it's in. Bag him. I need a portable chest x-ray and an EKG. Did you say ruptured spleen?
His abdomen's distended. The dog, they have this huge bull mastiff. He said it knocked him down a few times. It must have been the impact, not the bite. I missed it.
It's possible, but that is a big leap, okay?
Yeah, and it'll kill him if you don't move fast.
Hey, take a breath.
Take a breath? You just got here 5 minutes ago and you want to tell me what to do with my patient? You take a breath, dude. Sorry.
Name four kinds of nuts.
What?
Four kinds of nuts or get out.
Pistachio, walnut, almond, peanut.
Peanut is legume, but close enough. Give me the ultrasound.
Right away. You think I'm right?
Let's find out. Now that you've picked yourself out of the ceiling fan, I have a feeling you might be a pretty good doctor.
Now, Danny Sims, played by Willa Fitzgerald, is the kind of central character.
Yes.
Is she a likable character? Do we buy into her story? She seems to tell lies, to get away with patients, to bring them around to her way of thinking.
Yeah, that's sort of a thing thrown in by the screenwriters to kind of make you question whether or not her allegations against Dr. Xander Phillips are real. I don't think really anybody in this is a likable character. And it's kind of hard to follow their story sometimes. This series was created by Zoe Robin. But Carlton Cuse was very heavily involved, and Carlton Cuse's biggest hit before this was Lost, a show very famous for interrupting itself with these over-the-top flashbacks that just confuse matters. And we're getting more of the same here. Just as we're kind of maybe finding out a little bit more about the doctors, all of a sudden we're thrown into a different timeline, then another timeline. And I'm sure it's all adding up and I'm sure it's going to go somewhere, but it's just taking an awful long time. So the storytelling is quite untidy. Danny is probably, though, to answer your question, probably one of the more likable characters. People around her, though, Jack Bannon in this as Tom Cole, who's just this walking, talking red flag of a man. He's supposed to be playing this...
What is he now?
He's a surgeon in it who performs this reckless procedure on a paramedic who he may or may not be in love with, despite the fact that he's sleeping with another member of the staff. And he just thinks he's God's gift. And I think it's because of the fact he's... I feel as though...
He's a Xander supporter.
Yeah,
well,
he's a Xander supporter, and he doubts Danny when she comes forward with the allegations. And I feel as though he's supposed to be the charming British character. Oh, look, here's a sort of a Harry Styles sort of character. It's Pound Shop Harry Styles. Like, he's so unlikable and just insufferable. And there are various other characters like him. So the characters are not great. The CG, I should add, that Jen mentioned it earlier. I mean, you'll see better fake rain and better CGI in a Sharknado film. It's very, very poor for a Netflix production. I just don't think it has great ideas of its own. It sometimes plays out like a Grey's Anatomy knockoff, because every episode ends with this weepy pop number, and then sometimes it's like an unintentional comedy. There's one storyline involving a guy, this poor guy who lost his hand, and he's literally shouting, "Has anyone seen my hand?" And it's like, this is not a comedy.
And nobody cares.
And nobody. Because
they're all too busy wandering around. They have loads of time to talk to each other and give these grandiose monologues and moralistic speeches. Where Danny does that with the coach of the bus crash. She is like telling him her life story.
You'd like to say to her, are they not queuing up to get some, treatment?
No, the actual patients, the other patients, the young lads, are all standing outside trying to cheer the coach on to get the surgery. And like, for me, then I was like, It was like something from One Tree Hill, but at least with One Tree Hill, they had a dog eat the heart that was supposed to be done for the heart transplant.
Okay. Exactly. Okay. Like
stars out of five for Pulse from you, Jen.
Oh, it makes Casualty look like a gritty documentary. This is like absolute bottom of the barrel Grey's Anatomy, you know, copy, which, I mean, any Grey's fans out there, they would absolutely hate this. I think it could only get, I'm going to give it one.
Okay, Chris.
It makes Casualty look like a Ken Loach series. Yeah, like, look, it's so bad. I actually couldn't turn away. But nah, it's terrible. Two is probably too much. One.
Okay.
No, one.
Oh, all right. One and one for Pulse. And that's on Netflix. The Bonds Man with Kevin Bacon is available on Prime Video. And Dying for Sex is streaming on Disney Plus. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser, thank you so much. Hearing the ad there, and we are on to album reviews, and we're starting with Elton John. Elton John's five-decade career has cemented him as a cultural icon, while Brandi Carlile has spent 20 years shaping Americana and rock. A longtime admirer of Elton, Carlile joins him on Who Believes in Angels, a collaboration recorded just 20 days, capturing their shared musical spirit from different career perspectives. The Waterboys, led by Mike Scott, have evolved across 16 albums blending folk, rock and storytelling. Their latest, Life, Death and Dennis Hopper, is a sprawling 25-track tribute to the legendary actor, featuring Steve Earle, Bruce Springsteen and Fiona Apple in an exploration of Hopper's artistic highs and personal turmoil. I spoke to Mike Scott on Arena last night about why he is so fascinated with the late actor. Jinx Lennon, a punk poet and sharp social commentator, continues his raw storytelling with the hate agent's leer at the last Isle of Hope. This 26-track album dives into modern Irish life, tackling everything from far-right extremism to gym anxiety, with Lennon's signature wit and energy. I'm joined now by Kian O'Sullivan in studio, and Kate Brennan-Harding is joining us from the Galway studio. So let's start with Elton John and Brandi Carlile. This is the title track, Who Believes in Angels?
I have been there, man, I've been there. What do you say we set the pleasant trees aside?
That's Who Believes in Angels, the title track from Elton John and Brandi Carlile's album. Kian Sullivan and from Go is here with me, and Kate Brennan-Harding is coming to us from the Galway studio. Kian, Brandi Carlile admired Elton John like so many of us from afar, and she contacted him. She wrote him an old-fashioned letter.
She did, yeah. She's been a fan of him since I think she was the age of 11, and she reached out to him to just sort of, I guess, share her appreciation with him. And from there, they sparked this great friendship. They first collaborated on his 2021 album, The Lockdown Sessions, on this really gorgeous lilting track called Simple Things. And it obviously went well for the two of them because they've kept up this relationship. I saw them talking to Scott Mills saying that the two of them was hanging around together and listening to loads of music. When Elton's documentary on his Farewell Yellow Brick Road tour came out, he showed it to Brandi and she kind of wrote a song for him, and he took the lyrics and began crafting the music to it. And she was like, oh, it's supposed to be in 3/4. He was like, no, it's not anymore. I'm going to write it my own way. And they came up with this track, Never Too Late, which ultimately became the name of the documentary. And obviously this worked really well for them because now they've got a whole album together.
So Kate, I love the story of when Elton came to the studio and he had been very busy, so he was a bit exhausted, and they had only the 20 days to record the album, and he was grumpy as hell at the beginning.
Yeah, he was incredibly grumpy, but also he'd gone through a lot of personal strife. He'd fallen and hit his head. He'd had well-documented eye problems. He'd put this pressure, because of that documentary that was made, he'd put this pressure. The two of them were like, let's just do something wild. Let's go for 20 days and we'll just have to make something. And then, as anybody who's creative, they're like, yeah, we'll jump in. And then suddenly he was in panic mode. And his nervousness, so everyone can think, this is the great Elton John. How can he get nervous? He's spoken about his nervousness started to kick off in the studio. studio. The first 2 days of the first couple of songs, the first couple of takes, he was having absolute hissy fits, being the true diva queen that I think most people would associate with Elton. He was breaking his iPad, he was breaking his headphones, and I think Brandi Carlile spoke about it being quite an experience to witness. But all of this has been documented because all of this is going to be live tomorrow on YouTube, the recording process, which is the first time he's ever let anybody see his recording process. And he's in the moment. He's completely in the moment. So after the 2 days of not working, they came in, they suddenly took away what they had done, and they suddenly found their rhythm, and they get into it, and they get into it, in my opinion, perfectly on this album.
So pick out some of the tracks you like, Cian.
Well, I really love that title track that we played there. I think the duo sound really great on that track. I think they have this really kind of rich rapine over that slow, jaunty piano. I actually found it really akin to ABBA. I think it also has those kind of like 1970s references in there as well. I also think the closing track, When the Old World is Done with Me, which was a song written by Bernie Taupin, who was one of the four people in the studio along with Andrew Watt, wrote this song about John's impending mortality. And Andrew Watt encouraged him to sit down first thing in the day, sing it and perform it live in one take. And that's the version you hear on the album. And after that, Elton was so moved by it that he just burst into tears for 40 minutes. So I think that you can capture the magic of that in the song.
You can completely. I was listening to an interview with Elton about that, and I thought it was the most beautiful thing, because Taupin, Bernie Taupin and Elton John's relationship obviously has spanned decades, and you know, spawned multiple songs that are all hits. And when he received the lyrics for this, which was the day before, he couldn't actually face recording it because he was thinking, is it about me or is it about Bernie Taupin? And I love that continuous parallel relationship they've always had. It's a really beautiful track.
Yes, and I thought it was wonderful that they were all in the studio together, and that Elton John so admires Brandi Carlile that he would have brought Bernie into the mix, and that they'd be all there together.
I read somewhere, and it was a perfect analogy, that it's like Brandi Carlile is the love child of Elton John and Bernie Taupin. She fits in so perfectly, but at the same time maintains her own integrity and her own vocal and her own kind of unique authenticity, which I think comes across in this album. And I feel there's an awful lot of space in this album for each other. There isn't, oh, this is Elton bringing along Brandi Carlile. Like at the beginning of when they decided to record it, Brandi Carlile said, look, I don't really sell many records, Elton. And he was like, well, get ready, strap in, you're going to sell a lot of records now, you know.
Okay, well, stars out of five from you, Cian.
Yeah, I thought they worked really well together. I think these songs are robust. I think they get better with time. I think they're moving and adapting to keep your interest. And I think, I guess, at a certain point in your career, you just don't want to stand out for the wrong reasons. You want to blend in with the back catalogue. And I think they've done that really, really well. This is 4 out of 5 for me.
4 out of 5. And from you, Kate.
Well, I think this is a really, like, there's so many different themes on the album, but I think it's actually testament to, you know, friendships and friendships across generations. You know, Brandi Carlile and Elton, Brandi absolutely idolised him, and to have then come in and made this album together by stripping away her own love for him and just meeting him as equals. I just think they've created something that is future proof. I think it's 4.5 out of 5 for me.
4.5. Okay, that's for Brandi Carlile and Elton John, who believes in angels. The next album is The Waterboys, Kate. And this is their concept album, Life, Death and Dennis Hopper. It started with Mike Scott going to an exhibition of photographs of Hopper's and loving the work, and then really doing a deep dive into his life, that whole countercultural movement, as well as what a wonderful actor he was. Tell us what we have on the album.
So this is a really kind of wild exploration and imagination, imagining what Dennis Hopper's life was like, sort of like as an observer. Obviously, Scott kind of embodies, you know, Hopper sometimes, or then brings in different characters across the album. But for me, on listening to it, I felt like this should be turned into a biopic musical, in terms of, like, there's soundscapes, there's songs on it that, songs that don't have any vocals on it. And then he's brought in Steve Earle, he's brought in Fiona Apple, people, and he's brought in Bruce Springsteen, who all bring it through the lifespan, imagined lifespan. Obviously, this is art, and this is an imagined kind of recreation of some of Dennis Hopper's world and stories that we know of. And I think as well, what's kind of really interesting is that Scott has kind of left aside some of the Waterboys' classical sound. Some of it comes back in, the old stadium kind of fillers, you can hear the Waterboys very clearly, and others he's experimenting, and I think that that's a really amazing thing.
Yes, and there's a film that goes with it, which I think is on at the IFI at the moment, but will be hopefully picked up on TV soon. And one of the songs which we're going to play now, Hopper on Top, in the film, it's very psychedelic, it's very Dayglo, very much going back to the Dennis Hopper and the counterculture. That's Hopper on Top from the Dennis Hopper album from, what's it called? It's called Life, Death and Dennis Hopper from the Waterboys. And there's Mike Scott, who spoke to us last night. And you can listen back to that on Arena. Cian, it is jam-packed.
Yes.
It has, it goes through Hopper's life. There's all, there's even sections, instrumental sections, which talk about his five wives. And then there are these wonderful collaborations with Fiona Apple, Bruce Springsteen and others.
Yeah, I thought the Fiona Apple one was my favourite by far. She has this really wounded performance in a song called Letter from an Unknown Girlfriend, which paints a stark picture of Hopper as a romantic partner. And I guess that's juxtaposed by those five instrumental pieces by his five wives, which, I mean, I don't know, you know, how well what these women would say about these interpretations of their life, but you know, you've got, for the ballerina, it's more a former ballerina, it's an ambient piano piece. For the more countercultural Daria Halperin, it's a hippie free spirit sort of flute playing. So he tries to capture their essence in these songs as well. There's also this instrumental called Rock Bottom, which is kind of capturing Hopper's suicide attempt, where he tried to, well, people also just thought it was like a daredevil stunt where he got into a coffin with 17 sticks of dynamite. So there's a lot in here. It'll definitely bring you over to his Wikipedia page multiple times, like it did me listening to this.
Right, and did you like it? Did you like it as a concept album or as an album?
I definitely felt it was taking me through his life. Like, I really enjoyed the song about Andy Warhol and the sort of orchestral pop. I really enjoyed how the music kind of reflected the time that it was discussing, you know, from the countercultural 1960s. And then it kind of gets more kind of debaucherous when he's talking about the freakouts in the Mud Palace. I did think then there were songs that I felt could have been cut. I do think an edit would have been beneficial here. There's a whole song about how golf is a beautiful way to get to know your friends, which I was overly earnest for me. There was a song about James Dean giving acting advice, and the words were "live in the moment, baby." And I was like, I really haven't learned that thing here. But overall, I did think it was a really interesting thought exercise.
Okay,
I think it was
stars
well
out of five from you, Cian.
3 out of 5 for me.
3 out of 5. And from you, Kate, what are your thoughts overall on Life, Death and Dennis Hopper?
I can completely understand where Cian's coming from in terms of maybe an edit, but at the same time, because I just got completely into the world, I could see this cinematic scape where somebody was just kind of walking through the life, and I really felt immersed in it. I have to say, I really enjoyed, there's a complete instrumental track called Venice, California, Victoria, The Passing of Hopper, which is it's almost meditative because it brings in the lapping of the sea. It's got these kind of very eerie noises. And it is, you know, I suppose the musical representation of someone passing into somewhere else. And I just wanted to flag that because I think it was really beautiful. I've listened to that part several times. I think it's a treat for music and music lovers. I think it's compiled meticulously. I think it's a reflection of a life lived hugely. It's 4 out of 5 for me.
4 out of 5 from you. So that's 3 out of 5 and 4 out of 5 for Life, Death and Dennis Hopper from the Waterboys. We'll be talking about Jinx Lennon after this. You're listening to Arena's album reviews with Cian Sullivan and Kate Brennan Harding. Next, we have Jinx Lennon, known as the punk Christy Moore. His album is The Hate Agent, Leer at the Last of Hope. And this is Mad for Mass.
I will bring them back from the land of the north and gather them from the far ends of earth. All of them.
Bye for Mass.
Women with child,
I'm walking towards the Morris Chapel with my children. I said to them, come on and we see Jesus. They said, Jesus, boring. Don't be like that. Say a prayer for your granda and stop playing with the offertory candles. Can we go now? Give me a minute. I'm just getting into it. Because I'm mad for mass. Yeah, I don't like the sermons. I like the sound of the organ. They like each other when they like a breath of an angel. I'm mad for mass. I like the echoes on the altar. But I don't like the priestly frowns the way to pull you down. Because I'm mad for mass. Mad for mass! Mad for mass! Mad for mass! I'm mad for mass! Mad for mass! From the land of the north. I went to the chapel one week.
He is a once-off, isn't he, Cian?
He is, yes. So.
Yeah, tell us a little about him.
Yeah, so I guess he often described as sort of an urban poet. He's in this album. He you know, on the cover, he's at this anti-immigrant sort of he's at this kind of far right rally from an anti-immigrant perspective. And he's kind of covering those topics as well as sort of Catholic dogma and the overzealous of social media. So he's also capturing everyday Ireland, I think, in this album, and it's kind of done in these short. It's done by a series of very small ideas, I kind of feel like. They're really sort of localized ideas. You can imagine him kind of getting the inspiration and running to the studio and having something done really quickly. It feels very instant how he conveys his music. And like you described him there, yeah, he's kind of like a punk Christy Moore almost, and I would say the sonic mood board of like the Mary Wallopers, the Streets, and Sleaford Mods all mixed together.
Yeah, Kate, he does chronicle everyday life there as he sang in Mad for Mass. Mm-hmm. And as Cian says, then he's interested in the whole subject of ultra-right extremism and anti-immigration, and then he and he questions people within the song Stop Hiding Behind the Flag and others.
He does. Like, the thing is, there's characterization, humor, colloquialisms, it's all-encompassing, politics, punk, the state of anti-immigration, far-right sort of stuff, personal reflection and married life. And it's interesting, you know, I do get that these are little tidbits, but to me it feels like I've had a key and I'm suddenly inside Jinx's brain and I'm just listening to his internal monologue. And I find it incredibly... what I loved about this is I was trying to go for a walk and listen to all of it. I didn't get to on my walk, but it's like I was answering him back and I was arguing about certain things and I was laughing and laughing laughing at other things. He covers things in such a beautiful way in terms of, like, there's a song called BMW Drivers Don't Like Bikes, which as a former BMW driver I took exception to, but then realised he was right. I have to check my own rightness. Mad for Mass is absolutely hilarious because obviously he's dealing with his children and his kids. There's a beautiful song called Cyndi Lauper and Stop Me in Its Tracks because it's a rumination on him and his wife. They've been together for 14 years and they're getting that rare date night out, and it's just this beautiful kind of internal way of viewing the world, the way, you know, if you're sitting on the bus and you've got all your little thoughts coming through your brain, and that's what it feels like with Jinx, but packaged in this wonderful, wonderful, you don't know where he's going to go next. It's like techno ballads. It's brilliant.
Cian, do you think he gets that humour and observational wit, you know, that comes out in his lyrics, like we heard in Mad for Mass? Do you think that that makes his critique of the world more accessible?
I definitely think so. Like, he delivers it in such a charming, like, accent and turn of phrase that it feels incredibly authentic, and it feels very almost extemporaneous, as if you're kind of overhearing him, or as Kate said, it's an internal monologue in his head. So I think he's able to approach things with a sort of everyman stance that doesn't come across as sort of holier than thou.
Let's listen to a little of pub drama.
That is happening to you. Someone in the pub talks behind your back. There's a front door of the bar, but there's also a back. So take all your money and go somewhere nice. Depression is a thing that could give you head lice on you.
You could really hear people picking up those songs and having fun with them.
Absolutely. Depression is something that's going to give you head lice. That's something I haven't heard before.
So stars out of five from you, Cian.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I think there's a reason why we don't share our inner monologues. I think it comes across better when we take some time to finesse. And I would have loved if he could boil all these amazing ideas down into something that was more succinct, because I did feel it was kind of all over the place. But I think, you know, he's an incredibly individual artist and he doesn't need my opinion on that. So, yeah, 3 out of 5.
And from you, Kate, lacks finesse.
Yeah, I think it's about strapping in and enjoying the ride and then going back and rewinding and capturing those witty lyricisms and, you know, also very hard-hitting points too, and just makes you think. And an artist that makes you stop and think. The music kind of is under it. His lyrics are the most important part. But I absolutely loved it. And I think if you can get to see him, he's touring right now. And also, I'm a big supporter of DIY musicians.
Okay. Stars out of five, Kate?
4 out of 5.
4 out of 5 and 3 out of 5 for Jinx Linen. And my thanks to Cian Sullivan and Kate Brennan Harding. That's it for tonight's show. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields research. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Reg Luby. John Creedon is next.